So, I think we all agree in this room that we have a common father in Adam. We all come from Adam. And I think nobody can say no. Oh, no, you come from Adam, but I don't. It's like, and I think we can also agree that we all come from Noah, because there was like a major reset of the program through this flood. And so we all come from Noah. But when things get a little bit complicated is when we want to know from which of the three sons of Noah we come from. And that we don't know. And actually, maybe indirectly, because of like crossovers of lines of branches, maybe it's more than one. Maybe it's all three in different stages. But we don't know for sure. Now, when the Bible goes to Noah, and we're all always speaking about that tendency to go further and further away from God, when it comes to the three sons of Noah, and right after that, in the book of Genesis, you can later see it if you're curious about it, it just starts explaining how all the peoples of the earth come from these two. And it's very specific, because at least in the knowledge of peoples that the Bible had from that time. So this son of Noah is the father of these five, and from these five he is the father of this people, and then they went here, and then this is the father of these people. So you see how they populate the world. But if you analyze theologically that account, so when they're telling about it, they're not really trying to say that diversification of humanity, which would be something positive. We're diversifying, we're just filling the earth, kind of like doing what God wanted us to do, because to Adam and Eve, he says, just fill the earth. But it's giving an account of the division that is happening in humanity. It's a humanity that's competing against itself. A lot of wars going on. And in wars that started then and never stopped and haven't stopped till this very day. And we all know that very well. When we thought that the arms had gotten so strong that there won't be wars anymore, there they are. The wars just keep on going. So it's this division and this fight and this manipulation. In a certain way, it is the history more of wars than the use of people as if they were things, like lack of dignity. Just taking away the dignity of the person and make persons to an object. And we live that every day, not just by news of war, but just like normal advertisements, when you see that that women are used as sexual objects so pay attention, our product is good, no? And comparing kind of like the products to a woman, as if the woman was an object, objectivizing. So kind of like men are little soldiers that we can play with, and women are little dolls that we can play with. And it all happens here through these three brothers. It's not that they're in fault, but it's just like the division starts here. And as I told you, this meditation is about Epiphany. And it's very important to understand what is in the plan of the Bible happening in the Epiphany. Because these three wise men come from all over. And these three wise men are the three children of Noah coming back. With them, the whole humanity comes back. Because in a certain way, the whole humanity understand that we have a new common father that is not Adam, that is not Noah, but that is Jesus, the newborn king. And in him, we find unity again. And that is the beginning of what later will be the letter of the Ephesians chapter 4, when we're talking about unity and diversity. So you can have a world that is full of people, that they're all over the world, but of people that come together in Jesus Christ, and they ascend and descend and ascend and descend with Christ, and then they're diversifying. Because then what you're moving forward is not instrumentalization of people, but what you're moving forward is the grace of God that each receive by sharing his life in heaven. And so that's what's happening in Epiphany. And it's very important to know that. Through three, he calls to unity. Why were there three wise men? Why not four? Yeah, for the Trinity, certainly, but for the three children of Noah. Because he wanted to make that point. The humanity's getting together again. So that was the first part. Now, the second part comes from a composer that I really like. You cannot say that it's my favorite composer, but he's a very good friend. His name is Anton Bruckner. Anton Bruckner, for those who like classical music, is a quite famous composer. I mean, if you go to major concert halls around the world, he is definitely on the program. And his symphonies are definitely on the program. But different to most on-the-program composers, Anton Bruckner was very Catholic. He prayed the rosary every day. His best friends were Augustinian monks. He was the church organist for many years. He wanted to be a priest, but then he found out that it was not really his vocation. He didn't even start the seminary, but after a discernment, he just understood that he was not meant to be a priest, but he didn't get married. So he kind of lived for God and dedicated his music to God. And his music was very new. He was part of a movement that broke with classical rules in a time where there was the turn of the century, and some composers were very much attached to the forms of Mozart and Beethoven. And there were great composers too, including a very Catholic composer that I also love. His name is Antonín Dvořák from the Czech Republic. But from that line of Dvořák is also Johannes Brahms, very classical, very beautiful to listen to. But there were the other new composers, and Anton Bruckner was one of them, and their leader was Richard Wagner. You know, you've heard Richard Wagner. This is a new kind of music. And they take, and this is Anton Bruckner again, they are more than you know, giving a beautiful harmony for you. They are telling a story. And they are telling a story like as they're telling a tale, like a fairy tale. And therefore, sometimes it's not as repeating beautiful themes that the others have. Now, when I was listening to Bruckner over and over and over again, my long trips in Germany and in Austria and in Switzerland, that I really had to go through all that, and you think that it's wonderful, and it was wonderful, actually. But you know, I was really, and that was my work. It's like, what a dream, you know, to be doing that as what you had to do. And so I love listening to them, especially Bruckner. And I had this theory that he was telling parts of the gospel or parts of Revelation through his music. And one of the persons that I happened to visit with certain regularity is an expert of Bruckner. She wrote three books. Bruckner was part of an international society of Anton Bruckner. And she was very, very happy about my theory. She even invited me to give a talk that I said, I'm not going to give a talk. It's like, why won't you give a talk? Because I don't know about music. It's going to be full of musicians. And if they just ask me, what is G major, I will tell you that was the major of the city of Germany. And then everybody's going to laugh at me. And then she said, you're right, but your ideas are good anyway. So I told him this idea because in his symphony number 4, I saw the epiphany. Symphonies normally have 4 movements. And so the first movement is the King of the West. I don't know, think about a king of England or France or Germany, like medieval fairy tale, just put it all in. And then the second movement that normally in the symphonies is a slow movement, it's the king of North Africa. Kind of slow because it's the desert and it's warm, and so it's pretty hot. And then the third movement is the king of the Far East. And Far East means, yeah, maybe China, but also Mongolia or Russia or the Cossacks. And you know, this like huge distances that they have to travel in order to get to Jerusalem. And they're all traveling to Jerusalem. And so, this is what happens. In the first movement at the very beginning, this symphony starts with the star, like the star calling. A star that is, yes, it is a star, but it is also the sign of the new Messiah, the king that has been born. And of course, to make this the sound of the star, like kind of twinkle, twinkle, little star, a kind of jingle, but it's not like that. But it sounds like a star, but with a English horn, you know, that instrument that just looks like around and it goes like dun dun da da, like for the distance. Are you listening? Dun dun da da. And then the king of the West, which is first movement, he really hears that star, and he is like moved, like, whoa, there's a star there. It's calling. It's something wonderful. Something wonderful is happening in the East. I have to go there. We have to go there. This is the event of the millennium. I mean, I think this is the event of human history. Let's just go there. And then, of course, when he goes out with a theme of the King of the West. No, and it's like, beautiful theme that I just won't just do it for you now. I just don't want you to suffer right now. We're not in the Passion of the Christ yet. So and it's the theme of the King of the West, and in the symphony it's just beautiful. And you say, wow, yes, you feel that comes from trumpets of this castle of Buckingham Castle, or you think of even older castles, this castle in France north from Paris, or this castle in Western Germany, right very close to the big lake in the middle of Europe. And then they're coming out, and you feel this pride, this adventure, this fairy tale-like thing. And here we go. And then after giving the theme of the king, which is a wonderful theme, you hear that there's people coming with him, because it's not just the theme of the king, but also accompanying music that just gives you the idea, maybe there are women there, and then there are servants, and then there are children, and then you see the animals, and then they're moving with joy, with a lot of hope. They're coming out, they're crossing the channel, they go into France, they're going down from France, they move into Germany, and then into Switzerland, and they jump the Alps to go into Italy, and so on. So they are on their way. Now, this keeps on going, and it keeps on going for a long time, because the classic authors like Brahms and Dvořák were the bitter enemies of the new authors like Bruckner and Wagner, because they say they don't have a sense of harmony, they don't do things beautiful, and they do this huge sausages. And they never finish. It's true. Well, this fourth symphony of Anton Bruckner is 1 hour and 25 minutes long. So even if you are going to listen to that symphony, it's like, well, I'd rather see a movie. And each movement is 20 minutes long, at least 20 minutes long. Actually, it's a little bit, yeah, like 20 minutes long. But it has to be 20 minutes long, because it's not a short trip. And you have to feel that it's a long trip. And you have to walk along. So you're walking, and I don't know exactly where it is, you know, in the dark, in the black forest of Germany, where all that ham comes from. So you're, you're there in the Black Forest. I've been in the Black Forest, and it's really, I even got lost in the Black Forest, and it was already dark. It's like, oh, this cannot be happening to me. This is, he's going through the Black Forest, and he really doesn't see the star anymore, because the music is lowering its volume, and it's not as constant as it was before. So it's like, hey, what's going on? And then you don't hear music anymore. So you just go, and it's like something wrong with the stereo. It's like, and you're just putting up the volume to see what's going on. Is there music still playing? Yeah, but the numbers are moving, so apparently it's moving. And then all of a sudden it just starts again, and then you're like, oh, let's put the volume down again. So, but that moment in which you're not hearing the sound anymore is because he's having a crisis, the king of the West. He's not seeing anything anymore. He doesn't know where to go. Should he go right? Should he go left? Should he go up, down? He doesn't know. And he was so sure of himself. He left with so much baggage and with so much pride and with all the people that were around him and the people of his court. And nobody can tell him now where to go. He doesn't know that he's going to Jerusalem. He just knows that he's following a star. And he doesn't see the star anymore. And it's been a while since he hasn't seen that star anymore. So he's really considering giving up. Maybe I should just go back. But I'm not sure that I know the way back anymore. Or there's something awaiting for me back home. I just gave everything to this enterprise. But now I don't know what to do. It's kind of like a moment of desert, kind of what we should be getting in our Lent, where you say, you know, I want food, but I'm in the middle of a desert, and I can't die, and I cannot defend myself. And then for the first time maybe in your life, you really depend on God. And you look at God and you say, Lord, help me. I really don't know what to do. And that's not just the sentiment of this king of the West, but that's the sentiment of the prophet Jonah when he was swallowed by the fish, or for whatever creature it was that swallowed him. He was like, okay, I don't want to know anything about God. I'm going to Spain. And on the way, they throw him to the bottom of the sea, and he's swallowed. And I don't know how much time he spent there under the sea, but I think it's pretty boring to be inside the whale, like, for a long time. Like, I also admire Geppetto so much, because he was, like, there and kind of found something to do. But you don't know what to do. And then you don't know what's going to happen in your life. And then he just calls God. If you read the prophet Jonah in that chapter, I think it's chapter 2 or chapter 3, and he calls God, and he does this beautiful prayer from the depths of the sea, no? Or this psalm that says, from the depths I call to you, Lord, hear my prayer. And in Latin, it's de profundis, from my depths. So I don't know what to do. And then when he called, the Lord answered, and then the monster got up out of the ocean and just threw him in the beach. And then he knew where to go. He knew it all along. But now he's ready to go, because he had to learn through humiliation to be humble. And that is happening to the king of the West. And you can hear that in the symphony, that he doesn't know. And then the star shines again. He has made that experience. He prayed. And then the music starts moving again. You kind of hear the rhythm, the theme of the king again. It's taking rhythm. And then it just happens something fantastic. This first movement, it's just like 14 seconds long, maybe 18. Starts like in minute 9:20, depending on the director of the orchestra. Some are faster, some are slower. But all of a sudden, they're the most beautiful 18 seconds that I've ever heard in music. It's like, I've never found any other symphony by no one else or any other music that is so sublime as those 18 seconds. And then I thought, what was that all about? Where did that come from? And then he doesn't retake it again in the whole symphony. It was just that moment. And I think that that moment was a moment in which God showed him in a vision his glory, the glory of the king. So this is who you really are. This is what I think of you. And it was so much more beautiful than his own theme that he said, I was just so happy to be myself. And now I cannot wait to be really myself. And you see that. So he is with a new enthusiasm. And he starts going and going and going with his old theme. Yes, with the old theme. But it's not the same anymore. Because it's like he's not trusting in his own theme anymore. He just like says, I don't have another one for the moment. I'm just going through little by little towards the real theme. Until he goes into Jerusalem. That's the end of the first movement. Is this king just reaching Jerusalem in a very glorious and happy way. He's ready for what's next. And then we retake the second movement in the second king, which is the king of Africa. You know, that brown king that we see in the Christmas scenes everywhere. And it's so slow movement. I mean, second themes are always very slow, even with Mozart. And I remember when you were little, you kind of just wanted to jump the second movement to go to the third movement, which is happier. And I don't know what happens when you grow up. I mean, when you're older, well, now I'm 49, and it's like you start just liking the second themes, and you just want to hear second themes. Maybe your mood just changed, and you just became old. But you all also take a lot of pleasure or a lot of joy in understanding those parts of your soul that are sadder, but not because of they're sad, but because they're also part of you and they're also beautiful. And so this second theme is slow, maybe not so beautiful, just slow, because he's in the desert, and the rhythm, the movement really sounds like camels and like elephants, you know, like heavy. Boom, boom, boom. Ba-rum, boom, boom. And it's like the typical music where you're watching you're looking at your watch. It's like, how much more I'm going to listen to this movement? Is it as long as the first one? No, it's longer. So it's like, what's the point in hearing this movement? But then when the movement is about to end, you know, in the last moments when he's getting closer to Jerusalem, it's like almost as if he's playing the movement at speed 2, times 2. You've done that in some videos. And then it's so beautiful. And it's like, this was hidden. But it was also hidden from the king. And he just discovered how beautiful his theme was until he got close to God. And he got close to his objective. He never would have thought that he could sound the way he sounded. And the virtue of this king is that he never gave up. He said to the camels, come on, just 2 more minutes and we're there. Come on, just 2 more weeks of walking and we're there. It's like, don't give up. Even in the heat of the sun and everything. It's a different kind of crisis. It's not that the music stops, but there's also a moment in which you just want to give everything away. You just want to give up because it's so hot, because it's so long, because it's so many animals to feed. And I don't know, sometimes I just feel that I don't have water to give them. And then it comes to the third movement. And the third movement is always very, very joyous movement. And this is not the example. Actually, you wanted to skip to the third movement. And it starts, really, if you think of these But normally you have bad thoughts about it, because when the Mongols are coming, they're coming with their archers and they're just going to destroy. Or, you know, the Russians with their tanks. No, everybody's afraid of them, especially the Germans. And they're coming from far away, no? And it really sounds like horses. It goes like, da-dun, da-da-da-da-dun, da-dun, da-da-da-da-dun, da-da-da-da-dun, da-da-da-da-dun. And it's like, wow, this is amazing. I just want to ride with them. Let's just go and get and find this king in Jerusalem. Let's just ride together. But then, since it's also a long trip, and it's also like 17 minutes long or 18 minutes long, after you got the first impression, this is wonderful, then it starts again. And it's also wonderful, but when it starts for the fifth time, it's like, okay, I'm getting tired of this. I remember when the movie of Top Gun 1, not Maverick, but the Top Gun 1 opened, and that summer I went with my uncle to Washington State. They live so 40 minutes away from Seattle. And we saw Top Gun. And there was like, I don't know, part of the jingle or part of one of the theme songs of Top Gun was like, da 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 da, or something like that. No, and I was just saying it all the time. And then my aunt and my uncle got fed up with it. It's like with me just saying that. Stop it. It's like, you sound ridiculous. And then when my uncle said, okay, come. And then they have, I mean, they live in the middle of the forest. And so he said, you just go outside of my window, stay there, you're grounded, huh? And you just sing that like 1,000 times, and I'm going to be here in my room hearing you singing it 1,000 times. I already forgave him for that. So don't think. It took me many years. I was never angry. And so I was like all the time, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Poor kid. I feel sorry for that kid. And then there was a moment with Les, I don't want to do this anymore. Okay, you're ready. Come back in. And then I didn't do it anymore. So because there's a moment in which you say, I just can't do so much, and then stop, no more. So that's happening to this king. And it's not happening to this king because it just happens to like that theme. Because he doesn't know how to stop. He just can't stop. He doesn't know what's next. That's all he knows. This circle. And it's interesting that it's a circle and he comes from the east. Because we Christians, or the tradition, the Judeo-Christian tradition, redefined time. Because if you ask every people of the world from the past, and you see what were their conceptions of time, even such a Western people like the Greeks, they would all see the time as a circle. And you know, if you read the never-ending story, it's like the two snakes biting their tails. It's like always a circle, always a circle. It's like the karma of the Hindus, no? It's always a circle. Why do they think that? Well, actually, it's easier to think this than anything else. You just look at the window, and around January, you see white. It's like the snow. And then every time around the time of the summer, everything is green. And every time around the time of autumn, it's red and brown and yellow. And you see that year after year. And then even the day, well, it's the morning and the sun is there. And in 24 hours, the sun will be there. So that's time. I mean, it's just like a very natural way of expressing time. And actually, we also express time like in a circle. You just have to put numbers here. And it's a circle. So it's a very easy way to see the circle. The bad thing about the circle is that it doesn't have a beginning and it doesn't have an end. And we Christians, we don't believe that. We believe that the time had a beginning.
that God created the world, and that's the beginning of time. He's outside of time. He is eternity. And so when he said to the material world, be, then it came with a consequence of time. Because time is a measure, and it's a measure of movement. So if you are having movement, that means that you're material, that you can move. So that you are standing like that, but you can also stand in a different way. And then again, a different way. And so it has a beginning. That's what we believe. And it has an end. We hear from Revelation, if you read the book of Revelation, God will create a new heaven and a new earth. That's what we believe. It's part of our faith. It will be an end of time. And God will create another world. I don't know exactly how it is with time, but it's not like it is right now at all. Now, you can say, well, there are two different visions of time, no? The circular or the horizontal. But there is a point in that circle because there are cycles. And there's even a liturgical cycle. There's ordinary time, and then there's Lent, and then there's Advent. And then last year we had Christmas, and this year, guess what? We're going to have Christmas again. So there's a circularity in it. So time actually is just, it starts, but it has its cycles, you know? And that's what we believe about time. And these cycles are bringing you to an end of time. Now, if you use your imagination, just a little bit of imagination, what are these cycles? It's a tornado. And then there's the end of time. So that's what time looks like. And it's a time for understanding. He's giving us time for understanding. What's the meaning of life? What do we learn in the catechesis? Meaning of life is to know and to love Jesus Christ in this life, to be with him in the eternal life, right? That's what we teach our kids. That's the meaning of life. So what is creation all about? It's about knowing and to love God, and it takes time until at the end of time, when this creation disappears and a new creation takes over, we know and love God. So that's time. So this king, with its is living in a circle and doesn't know anything different as a circle. Doesn't know how to break the circle. He's looking for Buddha to give him some technique to break the cycle. Or he's looking at other techniques to break the cycle. It's all about to break the cycle. Just, I'm so tired of this. So tired that the only thing that I want to do is disappear and be part of nature. Be part of it all. And just don't think about it anymore. Because this is our daily problems. It's our pain. It's our sufferings. And that's what Buddha reacted to. You want to stop having pain. You want to stop having sufferings. Don't feel anymore. Disconnect. Which is totally different than the Christian message of Christ loving us passionately. His passion is totally against the teachings of Buddha. You have to get rid of your passions. And he loved us passionately because he wanted to exist. He wanted to love. And the others, they just want to cease to exist. But they want to cease to exist. I'm not judging them. But they're just focused in the greatness of nature and me being part of nature. And whereas St. Francis of Assisi, Jesus Christ himself, he would look at nature as like, I created you to be with me, to come back to me, to reconciliate everything to himself through Jesus Christ, the Word of God, who created everything. So when we are with your dog, it's great. But remember your responsibility. Even if the dog does not have intelligence, he can feel the goodness of the Creator through your goodness. So
you are kind of like the messenger of God for your puppy. And that's very important. But what I'm saying that is that for some people, it's the other way around. It's not, I am a human being with great dignity and I bring the creation through myself, yes, but to God. And it's not like I'm worth nothing and I just want you, creation, to take me over. As if the creation thought very high of itself. Creation doesn't think high of itself. Creation is in dire need of help. St. Paul, letter of St. Paul to the Romans. The nature is in dire need to help. The nature is not perfect. They also became duck trees and duck fish and duck water and duck clouds. It just touched it all. But now, let's go back to the king. And it's ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Now, when the king gets closer to Jerusalem, they just go out of the circle. And it just does like this, the symphony. And you can just almost feel the rest of the king of the east just saying, this is how this music stops, by getting close to God. Now, those are the first three movements. Now, what happens to the fourth? There are four movements, right? So you'll say, okay, three kings, let's go to the fourth king. Who is the fourth king? And you'll say, I know who's the fourth king. Jesus, the Messiah, the real king. No, the fourth king in this symphony is Herod, the king Herod. And he is the Antichrist. Actually, he is the first Antichrist, because Antichrist means I'm against Christ, I'm destroying Christ. And he is the first one who explicitly wanted to kill Jesus. So he is the Antichrist. So now this Herod seems to be good. And actually the fourth movement, do you remember how the first movement began? Dun, dun, da-dun. And it also starts like similar. Dun, dun, dun. Sounds good, like a call, but not exactly the same. Dun, dun, dun. Dun, 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 dun. And it's like, wow, this is evil. And it is evil. And but so in that movement, those three movements of the other kings just get together, and Herod makes all the inquisitions. Where is the new Messiah going to be born? And it's like, in Bethlehem. It's like, okay, just go to Bethlehem and say hello to the Messiah for me, and then just come back and tell me where he is so I can just go and adore him. So, okay, so the three themes of the three kings together, for the first time, they go out together and they're intermixing. So it's a very interesting combination of music. And then as they get close to Bethlehem, you know, the expectation just goes up and up and up. And you're saying, oh, yeah, I remember in the first movement, that minute 9:20, when there was this sublime movement. And, you know, that sublime movement was just the king of the West seeing his own glory. So now we're going to see God, you know, the face of God. This is going to be great. And then the expectation is high. And when they get there, instead of rising, it just goes down. But it doesn't go down in a bad way. It's just like it goes down because they were what? And then it just starts like a music for a child. Like literally, it's like a child moving with diapers, half naked. It's like, and the kings, the three wise men, are amazed. I mean, like in amazed in the sense of happiness. They're totally awestruck. This is, it couldn't be different. No other theme would have done justice to what we are seeing. So you only could give him justice by this theme of a little child. And you know, the little child, literally the music just makes you see a little child waving the hand to the kings, smiling at them, making them feel welcome through his face, through his big smile, through his eyes. And those wise men that have gone through hardships, through wars, through difficulties. You know, just like you have your U.S. Navy SEALs, and they come, and they're just like, oh, and then you're just touching the Jesus and the baby, and they're all very happy, as if they were like little children, no? And the baby's holding my finger, look at him, he's so great. And you know what's happening here? That because they have so much experience, because they know the world, they know that we, at least we men, not so much women, we're such show-offs. We just love to show off. It's like because we want to impress people, especially women, but we want just to impress people. So it's like, I've been there, and I've been to so many countries, and I've read so many books, and and I know this. Oh, yeah, I talked with Trump personally, and I did this, and I knew that he was going to do this and that. And I don't know, so many things just to show off. Just to say how tough we are, how much knowledge we have, how much ingenious we have, everything, huh? Just show off. Just like this meditation, it's just such a show off. No, so we are like that. And then they say, this is the king of the universe, and there's no one guarding the cave. No guards. He is totally... one can just go and kill him. And the only people that are here is this good man holding a staff and this lovely lady that just looks like the most warm person and most welcoming person that I've ever met in my life. And there's no one else here. There's just a donkey and a cow, and it doesn't smell that good. And this is the king of the universe. And it's like, he is definitely the king of the universe. Because only someone who was really, really powerful can afford being so small. That's a sign of real greatness. When you don't have to impress anyone. You're just free to love. You don't have to impress anyone. It's like, I've been waiting for you. And you know where comes my power? Because I know you, and I love you, and I've been waiting for you. And that's real power. Because you can be, you know, the king of this world and submit all the people by your hand, but you cannot move one heart one inch to love you. And this kid just moves all the hearts. He is really powerful, and they got it. So the end of the symphony is that after that experience, they don't go back to Jerusalem. They go back to their houses with a renewed hope, like knowing that salvation was at hand. They don't know if it's going to happen in 50 years or in 100 years or in 150 years. Doesn't matter. The salvation is at hand. They have seen the glory of God in Jesus Christ, and that's really the glory of God, because Jesus is not looking for a name. Jesus is completely the name of God. He is the second person. Is there a name higher than the name of Jesus? There's no other higher name. It's like he is completely his name. He's not looking for something else. And they've seen that, and then they can go in peace. Of course, the symphony later takes Mary, Joseph, and the kid to Egypt. It's part of the last movement. And then the kid comes back, or at least the symphony ends with Mary, Joseph, and Jesus just looking at the Holy Land as they're coming back from Egypt, and they're ready just to take over, no? Just to go to Nazareth. And that's the end of the symphony. So we took a long time for this meditation, 45 minutes.